Well, today we are talking with writer Craig Johnson. He is the New York Times bestselling author of the Walt Longmire mystery novels. They're the basis for Longmire, the television series. The latest book in the Longmire series is The Brothers McKay. And when Pepper McKay, one of the most hated men in Absaroka County, is found murdered in on his ranch at Crazy Woman Canyon, suspects are not in short supply. But Sheriff Walt Longmire's attention is on those who had gathered for a family meeting that evening. McKay's very different sons, a smooth-talking charmer, a cosmopolitan journalist, a reclusive monk, and a half-native ranch hand who keeps the place running. Each had a motive. Each claims he's innocent. As Walt investigates what happened that night in the OK Lodge, he's pulled into a tangle of old grudges, long-buried secrets. Then the case takes a sharp turn. A second body surfaces. Wildfire tears through the canyon, trapping Walt and forcing him into a fight for his life. Both the killer and the elements close in. Craig Johnson is the recipient of two awards from the Western Writers of America, the Spur Award for Fiction, the Owen Wister Award, as well as the Mountain and Plains Independent Bookseller Association's Reading the West Book Award for Fiction, and author of many Longmire novels. Always a pleasure. It's great to welcome you in again, Craig Johnson.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
A year ago, we were able to meet in person. That was a joy.
We had a great time. Yeah. I really enjoyed that. You're a fantastic interviewer. That's the reason.
Well, you're great. I tell people they ask me who's your favorite interview. I said, well, one of them is Craig Johnson. So, right back at you. So this book, I understand, is Brothers Karamazov.
It is essentially,
and I understand that you read this book when you were a teenager.
I had it forced upon me when I was very young. I was something of a pretentious reader like that, and my father was aware of that. And one of the things he did was, every Christmas, one of the big things in my family was where you give a gift of a book on Christmas Eve. And I think my father was trying to maybe, teach me a little lesson there, like that when he dropped the Brothers Karamazov on me when I was about 13 years old, which is a little young, to attempt to read that particular book. I mean, it's one of the great novels of all time like that, but it's very complex, like it has a lot of layering to it. And he dropped that on me on Christmas Eve, like that, and I read that book, for the better part of a week. And finally finished it off. And of course, the thing was with my father, he didn't just get to read the book. You had to give a post-mortem. You had to give some sort of like response as to what you thought about the book like that. And he called me in his den, and I remember him stuffing his pipe and looking at me and going, well, what did you think about that book that I gave you? And I said, well, I think it's one of the most incredibly layered novels of, family, of culture, of society, of theology, of politics, of all of these things, and patricide. I think I included that last one just for him. And then I said, it's also one of the worst murder mysteries ever written. And he looked at me with a little bit of a startled look on his face and said, well, what makes you say that? And I said, well, if you don't know who the killer is, by chapter 8, you're kind of a moron. And he said, there might be some information you may want, before you make that particular judgment. And one is that, Dostoevsky was going to write that as a trilogy. The Brothers Karamazov was supposed to be three different novels, and he died 4 months after he wrote the first one and never got the chance to write the other two. Do you think it's possible that maybe he was like doing a little bit of a red herring thing there, where he was leading you in the wrong direction, who you thought, was the murderer, wasn't actually the murderer? And because he had two more novels, that he was going to be writing about this family like that. And, boy, that haunted me for 50 years. I walked around trying to think about who it was that could have possibly been the murderer, and never could really come up with a solid answer on that. And I was actually visiting my French publisher and translator and Sophie Aslanides, and she actually knew about my great quandary with the Brothers Karamazov. And she said, well, do you know about those three scholarly papers that have been written about, you know, what who these, you know, scholars think actually might have been the murderer and the brothers Karamazov. And I said, no, look at it. And she goes, yeah, there are three of them that have written these papers. And I said, I've got to read them. And she says, well, they're not translated into English. And I said, well, now that's not going to be very helpful. And she said, well, you know, we actually have somebody in the office, like at EKA, like at who you know, is Russian, like that. And so she could probably give you like a Reader's Digest version of those pages, like that, and give you an idea of who it was that they think it was. And she did, like that. And the next morning I came into the publisher's office, like that, and she had those pages laid out and for me, like that, and I started reading them. And they just blew me away. Like I couldn't believe, like that, you know, how concentrated, you know, and how totally, you know, believable they were as far as, you know, the believability factor of who it was that might have killed the old man and Brothers Karamazov. Like, and each one of them had a different suspect. They were not all in agreement. Like, and so that was very interesting for me also. And you know, I thought to myself, you know what, after all of this labor and all this work and all this angst that I've stored up for 50 years, I'm going to use this as a Walt Longmire mystery is what I'm going to do. So it became rather obvious to me that there were some really strong connections like that, you know, between a small Russian village of that period of time and contemporary small town Wyoming. I mean, if you've got somebody, you know, in the county who's a much hated individual, it makes for a number of really difficult situations, you know, for any kind of investigator, because boy, you have no lack of suspects in who it is that might have killed Pepper McKay. And it was actually very, very fun to do a more classical kind of mystery novel with that, a more Agatha Christie type of thing like it. And I had a blast writing it, I have to admit.
Do you, I can't remember if I asked you this before, do you read Agatha Christie?
I
Admire her.
do. Oh,
She
yes.
she's lauded for her plots, right? And keeping you guessing all the way through.
Oh, like, I mean, I even used one of her novels, like, as the basis for one of mine, like that, just as an homage, like, to her. It was called Western Star, like that. And it was actually a takeoff of her Murder on the Orient Express. I discovered that the Wyoming Sheriff's Association used to have their meetings on a train down in Cheyenne that ran all the way across the length of Cheyenne of Wyoming and back. And I thought, oh my gosh, a train full of sheriffs like that. Now that is just, you know, an Agatha Christie waiting to have happen. And it's kind of funny because whenever Walt is getting ready to climb on that train, and he's a young deputy, you know, he's the only non-sheriff on there. He's the lowest man on the law enforcement totem pole like that on that train. And he's getting ready to climb on there, and he's got it in his back pocket. A copy of Murder on the Orient Express. And one of the older sheriffs looks at it as he's climbing on the train and says, well, she pretty much had it figured out, didn't she? And Walt says, I don't understand what you mean. Look at it. And he says, well, that Agatha Christie, he says, you know, son, there's only so many permutations you can have in this situation. He did it. She did it. They all did it. Nobody did it. She did all of them. Like that. And so it was a nice way of being able to say that she was kind of the master of what it is that we do. Her plots were just extraordinary like that. And I love, you know, the depth of her characters. And I mean, there's a reason why The Mousetrap is one of the longest running theatrical productions in London that's ever been, still running after its opening, I think in the 1930s or early 1940s or whatever. So anyway, I like to draw from as much classical literature as I can, just simply because it's so beautiful, it's so workable, and it gives another layer to the books. You know, that to me is really, really important. I don't want to write formulaic mysteries like it. I want to write books that have a lot of layers to them, whether it be classical literature, whether it be social commentary, whether it be humor, whether it be history. You know, all of those things. Whenever somebody picks up one of my books, I want to be able to hit them on a number of different levels so that they can really enjoy the time that they spend with Walt Longmire.
I want to take you back to you know, growing up. That's fascinating. Your dad's assigning you classic literature. That's, I mean, that's great, right? I don't know what your
I
school
think he
was.
was body slamming me with classical literature was what he was doing.
So first of
But
all, what
it
was?
worked out. It was okay. Like I was able to suffer the damage, you know, it did to my psyche.
Yeah, you turned out okay. What was he reading? I guess a broad range
You
of
know,
things.
he read everything. He was one of those guys. Like I grew up in one of those families that had like stacks of books everywhere. You know, our idea of hell in our family was to be trapped somewhere without a good book. And, you know, I just remember stacks of books, you know, and shelves of books, you know, everywhere, all over the house. And, you know, only those of us who read I mean, you read, it's very depressing to read like the statistics and see how few, people, more and more people are reading less and less these days. Like, and how many people graduate from college and never read another book again in their lives. Like, and only those of us who do, read on a regular basis know just how much of an addition it is to our lives, like, and what a difference it makes. I mean, they've done all these scientific studies, where they've done brainwave pattern studies, like, get to find out, what it is, what activities it is that stimulate your brain more than anything else. And of course, the absolute winner is reading, because you're doing so much of an interpretation. I mean, it's the author's point, to stack those dominoes of words up there and tip that first one over. And then it's your job to, create that universe, for that, book that you happen to be reading. And so it stimulates so much in your head, like that, as opposed to, maybe, TV and movies, where, so much of the time, you're just sitting there with someone else's imagery and someone else's world of you and universe just washing over you like that. And so I'm a big proponent, like, for reading, like, and I think that's an important part of having a full and robust life, to be honest.
Well, certainly, I described in the synopsis here, I'm describing the Suns as you wrote them. All right. Smooth talking charmer, cosmopolitan journalist, reclusive monk, half native ranch hand. You can see the Brothers Karamazov patricide, right?
Oh, yes, so absolutely.
Those plot elements, although it's broader, not only the Suns are suspects, but just about everybody in Absaroka County, right?
Everybody in the county, like that. It actually led to one of my favorite scenes in the book, like that, where there's a scene where Walt has to go and do an interview, like that, of his individual. Like, who does have a history with Pepper McKay, like a fellow by the name of Boris Aguirre, and he's a Basque, heavy equipment operator there in the county. And Walt goes and pulls up like that road, like that, and he's got a history, of violent acts before. And so Walt kind of has to find out, what it is that's going on between these two to see if maybe he might have been an actual suspect, in the murder. And he swings around like that, and drops the bucket, about 8 inches from Walt's boot, like that, and then kicks open the cab and pulls out his cigar and relights it and says, "Well, why are you here?" And Walt says, "Well, I would assume you know why I'm here." And he says, "No, I don't." Look at it, and he says, "Well, somebody killed Pepper McKay." And he looks at Walt and says, "Well, that's the best news I've heard all week." Look at it, and he says, "Well, now you might want to rethink your statement like that, since you're kind of high on my suspect list." And he asks Walt and says, "Well, how was he killed?" Like that, and he says, "Well, somebody hit him in the back of the head with a rock." And he says, "Well, that's downright biblical." Like that, and Walt says, "Well, then do you mind if I ask where you were Tuesday night?" And he goes, "Well, hell, I was out picking out a rock. What do you think I was doing?" And all of the Wyoming sheriffs I've talked to are always like, "Yeah, that's pretty much how an interrogation goes in Wyoming." I think, even if you're being suspected of a murder, you got to keep your sense of humor. And, that was actually the fun part, to see those coalitions like that between the classical piece of literature and then how I could utilize it to make it work in contemporary Wyoming.
So you've said that if a character pops up with a sense of humor, that character is probably going to survive.
He was a classic example, as a matter of fact. Boris was one of those ones that I was going to actually think about killing before the book was over with. And my wife, Judy, has this, like, rule. She's like, "You don't kill funny, all right?" Like that, when you're doing these books and you stumble onto a really funny character, because you never really know, like, if it's going to work or not. And none of the characters have the same sense of humor as any of the other characters. But whenever you introduce a character like that and they have a really great sense of humor, they have a much better chance of surviving the book, because, you do want to bring them back, and utilize them again in future novels like that. And I thought, this heavy equipment operator, probably Walt, we'll see him again somewhere down the line like that. And so you got to be careful with those characters and try and nurture them along and not kill them off too quick.
I found this on Longmire Literary Society. I don't know if you're familiar with this, a Facebook page. Dedicated to your works, Longmire Literary Society. And I found this question from they took up your 26 pickup, number 14. This is your newsletter, I think, right? Your notes to readers. Here's a question from a reader called Robert. He said, "I've noticed that you do a lot of public appearances at bookstores, libraries, and literary festivals here and overseas. How do you balance the public social life with relative solitude of being an author?" I love that, and then you answered it, but I'll just Have you answered that and then maybe do a couple of follow-ups? I thought it was an excellent question.
Yeah, it was. Like I enjoy those. Like you know, it gives me a chance to write like a quick, you know, one-page essay, you know, in response, like to things that maybe I don't ever really think about, you know, because it's there's nothing quite, you know, as revealing as a fresh set of eyes. Like I'm fortunate in that I've got like an awful lot of fresh sets of eyes, like looking over my work and looking over my shoulder as I do what it is that I do. Like and I almost consider them to be partners in crime with the Walt Longmire books. Like no pun intended. Like that, and or maybe pun truly intended, and anyway, like that. Yeah, that you know, there's a strange kind of quality, you know, to being an author like that, especially one that's maybe not so, you know, J.D. Salinger kind of esque, you know, where you actually do go out, you know, and do a lot of events. My wife Judy kind of teases me about it a little bit because she's always like, you know, not everybody's good at this, and not everybody wants to go out like that, you know, and be in public, you know, and be, you know, entertaining and all those type of things. Like her statement is that just because someone sits in a room and types about their imaginary friends doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be, you know, good with social skills. Like, and so I imagine that's probably true. But I actually enjoy it. I have a really good time going out like that and doing the tours like it. I mean, my tours are usually about 3 weeks, you know, to close to a month long whenever a new book comes out. And I enjoy that. You know, I enjoy going out and talking to people who've read the books, like at seeing what their opinions are of it, good and bad, like that. And it's kind of nice, like to have that kind of a relationship, that close of a relationship, you know, with the readers, like it. And, you know, one of the elements of that, of course, is that, you know, I've got a website, craigallenjohnson.com, and there's a contact button on that. And I always laugh like that because people will write me an email, and most generally they start off with the phrase, you know, whoever it is responsible for answering Mr. Johnson's emails on this website, like that. And I'm always standing here at the ranch in the kitchen, you know, looking at the computer and going, well, that would be me, like, you know. So, yeah, it's, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I like, you know, hearing from people and talking with people and answering their questions. A lot of times they'll have like, you know, little questions about the book, something that they didn't understand or something they didn't get or something that they did enjoy, something they wanted to point out to me like that and say that this was like a really, you know, great moment in the book or, you know, an interesting fact that I wasn't aware of or things like that, which I think, you know, you wouldn't normally be able to get that if you didn't have that connection. But then there's the other side of the coin, of course, like, you know, with what it is that I do for a living. And, you know, that is that I do sit in a room by myself typing about my imaginary friends, you know, for like, you know, days, weeks, months on end. I mean, people don't know about that so much. They know about the public events. They know about the public events and going out and book tours, you know, and literary festivals and all those type of things like that. But they really don't hear so much about it, you know, when I just creep up into my loft like it and spend an entire day up there writing or an entire week up there writing. And, you know, that's where the work comes from. If I wasn't writing these books like it, then they wouldn't be emailing me or talking with me all so much. But I'm able to balance that at least relatively well, just simply because I do think that I'm kind of like a living embodiment of my parents. Like that, my father was an extraordinary man like that, but he also was, he really wasn't very socially oriented. I mean, he could go out and be social like that, but it wasn't something that he enjoyed. You know, he really liked reading. He liked being alone. He liked, you know, that kind of isolation, you know, kind of, you know, isolationistic kind of quality to his life like that. And my mother, on the other hand, was a gadfly like that. She loved going out and she loved being social. She loved going to parties. She loved doing all this. She loved to dance. She loved all of these things. And so I think, you know, I've got a little bit of those two wolves in me like that, you know, kind of fighting, you know, for domination, you know, on either side like that. And fortunately, I found a living where I can actually use both of those to, you know, make an enjoyable life.
I want to ask you about that 80%. You're sitting in a room by yourself typing about your imaginary friends.
About right. I might be even undercutting that. It might be more than 80%.
Right. So we talked about this character that appeared with a sense of humor. I wonder how much. Of course, these are your creations, but they kind of take on lives of their own. I wonder what that it's a mixture, I guess.
They do like that, but it's like, as the saying goes, you're the only one in the room. I mean, they can all be different, like facets, of your personality or ones that you can adopt or something like that. But I'm not a big believer in that whole psychobabble kind of like, oh, the characters just start talking and I just see where they're going like that. I don't really think that that's, an honest response, into the writing process. I think what it is basically is it's all part of you. It's different facets of your personality or your character like that, and you need to just find that seed of those characters like that to make them believable like that and give them a fair shot at setting at the table that is that novel. One of the things I never want to do is I never want to have Walt up against somebody who I don't think has a good chance of being able to defeat him. And that means that you have to give the proper motivations and the proper caliber like that to those supporting characters, even the antagonists that are in the books. When I was writing the first book, The Cold Dish, one of the big things I thought was, okay, you're going to have to get to a point or a position where you're going to understand how it is that somebody would actually be pushed to the point where they would do something rash like kill somebody. And that was a major leap for me, like that, and I had to think about it a good long time, like it, and finally came up. There was a plot and a scenario that made me believe that, yeah, I think even a good person could be pushed, to a certain point, where they might do something rash. And that's important, because, otherwise, you're just doing comic books, and that's just not very enjoyable to me to write about.
We're talking with the author Craig Johnson, author of the Longmire series. Pleased to have him on today. We're going to have much more with him. We'll take a brief break right now. Back with Craig Johnson. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're pleased today to have writer Craig Johnson with us. He's the New York Times bestselling author of the Walt Longmire mystery novels, which are the basis for Longmire, the television series. Latest book in the series is The Brothers McKay. You can find out more about Craig Johnson at his website, craigallenjohnson.com, including upcoming events. So you're going to be at Warland, Wyoming, coming up, and then in Colorado, Nebraska, South Dakota. So on the road again here shortly, I suppose. I wanted to talk about law enforcement. You're of course, Walt is a sheriff. And you're known among the law enforcement community. You hang out with them, I guess. You get ideas from them. One thing I was watching an interview you were giving, an event, and you're a celebrity in Wyoming, such as Wyoming celebrities go, right?
That just means the bar for celebrity in Wyoming is
very,
extraordinarily low.
Very low. But especially among the law enforcement community. So do you ever get a ticket, speeding ticket in Wyoming?
I have like that, but generally what's happened recently is I get lectures is what I get. Like whenever they get up to the window, I'm always like, just give me the ticket. And they're like, no, you're gonna get the lecture like that. You know better than this. Like that, I have a little bit of a lead foot like that sometimes. So that puts me in contact mostly with the Wyoming Highway Patrol like that. But yeah, no, there are 23 experts, in the 23 counties of Wyoming. That have sheriffs like that, and they're all experts, on Walt Longmire and things that he comes up against like that. And so it's always entertaining to me, to see what it is that they enjoy, in the books like that, and what things they take umbrage with like that. And so it's kind of fun for me like that to have them looking over my shoulder too, look at. And then, I've spoken to the National Sheriffs Association like that, and all of those. And I think what they enjoy is that, the fact that, first of all, Walt really does deal with the things that sheriffs, deal with. He actually finds himself in these same situations that they find themselves in, like that. But I have to admit that the majority of the time, the reason for that is because it's newspaper articles that are the catalyst generally for just about all of my novels. Like that, generally, I'll spot, because I pick up newspapers everywhere I go. Like that, it's a occupational hazard as I travel. Like that, and if I see, a story that I think, okay, yeah, no, that's something to do with law enforcement and sheriffing, and that might just work as a Walt Longmire plot. I'll use it like that, and it keeps the books grounded in a reality, Where Walt, deals with the things that sheriffs deal with. Now, that doesn't mean that there won't be certain departure books where I'll take Walt out of his comfort zone like that and have him, dealing with some exotic situations and exotic places and everything, just to break things up and make things a little bit different. Because the one thing that I want to guard against more than anything else is to make sure that the books don't become formulaic. When you reach a point of like, 20 some, I think this is the 23rd book is coming out, I think in the spring, like that. And then there's also a collection of short stories that's coming out in November. You've got a body of work there, and you really need to make sure that, that body of work, is still stretching, that you're still attempting to do new things with each novel, like that, and not falling back on old formulas or ways of like, writing the books that you may have used before.
So there are, obviously changes in law enforcement. Some things stay the same, some things change, including technology. I recall you when you first wrote The Cold Dish, you were kind of pushing back on this idea of too much technology and law enforcement as superheroes and kind of unrealistic. But I wonder lately how are things been changing in law enforcement? You've talked to these sheriffs, and how do you incorporate that in your books?
Well, thank you for noticing that. Like that's one of the overriding themes, I think, to the books, with the start of The Cold Dish, the very first novel, in that, there just seemed to be this like belief that, the technology and the DNA and the ballistics and the forensics and all this kind of stuff, that there was like this godlike aspect, to technology. And, there's nothing quicker that can show the shortcomings of technology than, possibly Mother Nature. And, here in Wyoming, we come face to face, is the least populated state, in the country, with nature an awful lot of the times. So extraordinarily vast, areas of the state, and I can always tell when somebody's not from Wyoming when they come up to me and say, "Why doesn't Walt carry a cell phone?" And I'm like, "Have you ever been to Wyoming?" Like, a lot of the time, it simply doesn't work. Like, if it doesn't have service, it doesn't work. Like, and so there are a lot of shortcomings to a lot of that technology. And I'm getting to something with this, like that, in that when I write the books, I also discovered early on, like at that, I was always annoyed whenever I would be reading a series of books, like, and they would like jump a year ahead, and I thought, there should be more continuity, to these types of books. And I thought, I'll do a Vivaldi is what I'll do. It'll be four seasons, so that it takes me four books to get through 1 year of Walt's life. And that accomplished a couple of different things. First of all, there was a continuity to the book so that no book was any more than like 4 months away from the previous or following book, like at which gave a continuity. If Walt's finger is broken in one book, he's still got the splint, on his hand in the next book, which I found comforting, like that. And then the other thing was an unexpected benefit where Walt, it takes me four books to get through 1 year of Walt's life, like that. So I'm past, 20 books already, and Walt's only 4 years older than when we first met him in The Cold Dish. And people that pick up on that, the one statement that they generally make is, "Yeah, but technology has changed a lot, like in the last 20 years, like it." And I'm always looking at him and going, "Yeah, no, not in Wyoming, it hasn't. No, like so that there are a lot of shortcomings with that technology when you live in very rural areas. I mean, obviously, I've slipped up a few times, like getting used to little things like that might not have been quite available, all those years past, like that. But the unexpected benefit of that, of course, is I just did a talk, like at with Tess Gerritsen, like it is doing a piece like at about the aging of a lot of crime fiction protagonists in the New York Times, like it, and I told her about the Vivaldi thing like that, and I said that the great thing about it is that I have slowed down his aging process like it. And so I don't know, Tom, at one point in time I'm going to be older than Walt, and I don't know if I like that idea at all,
Right, right. Yeah. So you do approximately one per year up to 22. Next will be 23. I'm assuming you're, just going to continue until the unlikely event that Walt becomes boring to you. But I'm wondering, people and you're aging, and I think readers probably worry about that. I'll give an example. Robert Caro is still working on his wonderful series on Lyndon Baines Johnson, and all of us fans of that series are just hoping Robert Caro holds on, doesn't die, right? So I wonder, is Longmire going to live as long as you do?
I don't know. I mean, the big question there is not so much your longevity or anything like that. I think what it is it's always going to come down to does he have more stories to tell? And generally, the example that I get is well, are you going to get tired of Walt the way that Arthur Conan Doyle got tired of Sherlock Holmes? And I'm like, well, I do have a little bit of an advantage in that my protagonist is not a cocaine addicted sociopath, and so he's got some awfully wonderful qualities, and I really enjoy his company. And as long as there are stories to tell, with that character, and they do, continue to be different and inciting, intellectually, then I'll continue writing the books like that. But then on the other hand, I mean, there's also got to be that moment in every book where you think to yourself, I don't know if he's going to make it this time. You really have to kind of write all the way up to the edge where you're not sure as to whether or not that character is, actually going to survive. And there's a big moment like that, with the forest fire scenes that are in the Brothers McKay. We had a very huge forest, rather plains fire out here near the Powder River, about 3 miles from where I'm speaking to you now, from Ucross, population 26. And I remember flying in the night, that the fire was happening. And even from 19,000 feet, you could see this wall of fire going all stretching all the way from the north area of the Powder River country to the south. And I just thought, I got to get home and try and protect my home. And I thought to myself, whenever this when I was writing this book, I mean, they call it a novel for a reason. It's not going to be Walt playing pinochle on his desk. It's got to be something interesting happening at interesting times in an interesting place. And so I thought, okay, well, what would be the worst, place you can think of, to have a forest fire? And the answer came back immediately, which was Crazy Woman Canyon. Which you may not know Crazy Woman Canyon, but you do know Crazy Woman Canyon, because if you remember the old movie, Jeremiah Johnson with Robert Redford, there was the scene where the woman whose husband and children had been killed by the Crow Indians, and she's there, alive still, but the Indians won't touch her because they think she's touched, and that means she's big medicine. And that's actually where that took place. But it's this marvelous canyon with these 1,000-foot granite, walls and, waterfalls coming all the way down. But it's also, a funnel. And so if you had a fire coming in from the high country and coming down on either side where the fuel is on that canyon, it would close up at the end and you wouldn't be able to get out like that. And of course, when you're reading the book, there should be that moment where you really do think, is this it? Is this the last Walt Longmire book? And I think that raises the stakes, and I think that's one of the things I think also crime fiction and thrillers tend to do. They raise the stakes, remarkably, where it's life or death. It's not just, are you bored and want to, get a divorce and, have a new life. It, that your life is kind of on the line here.
Let me go to this next. I'll hold a question. I think a question that listeners have or readers have a lot. Well, maybe I'll just bring it in here. So Walt's now
This
engaged.
is a long windup for a question. I
That's a
can't wait
long
to hear
windup for
this.
a question. It's a long windup for a question. It'll probably be badly disappointing to you. But Walt's engaged. I know I've seen readers ask.
Kind of. He kind of is. Look at, she doesn't seem to be
kind
cooperative.
of. Is he ever going to get married? Are you ever going to marry Walt off?
That one, I don't know if I have an answer for that question like that, because I'll be honest with you, Vic is such a wild card. I mean, you can see why it is, that, enough time has gone by like that, since the demise of Walt's, wife. And and he's, he's got to kind of move on with his life after a certain point in time like that. But Vic is such a wild card like that, and you never know, what her response is going to be to some of these things like that. And so it's a very much a high and low kind of relationship, to see what's going to happen. And I remember when I first started out writing, I had a lot of other authors giving me advice, and they said, well, now you can have, sexual tension, between some of your characters, but you can't have anything happen for 17 or 18 books. And I was like, well, wait 17, 18 years for something to happen. What kind of women are you dating anyway? Like that, they're very, that's an extraordinary amount of patience, like, had to put into a relationship like that. And so I just thought, you know what, third book, something's going to happen. And that was the book that took place in Philadelphia when Walt's daughter gets hurt like that. And my thoughts were, you know what, all this is going to do is complicate their relationship, is all it's going to do. And I am a firm believer that, any series of books kind of relies on the complexities of the relationships and of those characters. And so I kind of drove that, really as hard as I could, so that it would make for something interesting, like it to continue in the books and didn't become formulaic. And I think it's worked out really, really well like that. I mean, there are some people that root for them to get together. There's some people that root for them to never get together, and I'm okay with that, having people on either side of the board there.
Let's take another break. We'll come back with more with Craig Johnson. He's the New York Times bestselling author of the Walt Longmire mystery novels. The latest one is called The Brothers McKay. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Pleased to be talking to Craig Johnson today. He's, of course, the New York Times bestselling author of the Walt Longmire mystery novels. The latest one is The Brothers McKay. Craig Johnson, I was reading or watching something, an interview that you gave where you were talking about the joys, the benefits of writing a series. But there's probably difficulties as well. And you were remembering in this interview that that your wife reminded you that you mourned the end of the Cold Dish. You thought that was going to be the only one, I guess. And before you got the chance to do a series, I guess my first question on this is, you mentioned continuity. How do you prevent continuity errors when you're doing a series?
I have a couple of secret weapons. Look at one is the major distances in Wyoming are that, if you want a gallon of milk, you have to drive 30 miles to get it. Look at, and so, there's a lot of times I'm driving long distances, especially when I'm doing like library events or any of those kind of things here in the state like that. And of course, what I, all right, this is where I give away my age a lot like that. I still have a CD player in my 25-year-old truck, and by golly, it's still working like that. And I have this incredible secret weapon called George Guidel, who does the audio versions of my books. And what I do is I take those CDs. Remember back in the day, remember books on tape with cassettes? Like at least I'm a little past that. Like I've got them on CD. Like, and what I do is I stick George in the truck, like, and listen to some of my older books. If I know that it's going to harken back the current novel, to one of the more previous novels, like it, then I'll get that book out and listen to it and see what kind of information I might have left for myself, because I do leave myself a lot of little, bookmarks in the plots, of books, for future books, for things that I might want to write about somewhere down the line. Or, there's also that constant movement of characters, like a chessboard, basically, where, you're going to pick out, the voices that you need, kind of like a choral group. You're going to have certain voices that you need for certain books. And so you want to go back and find those voices and find those characters from previous books and see, okay, not only, who are they, what are they, but how did they speak? What kind of, language and syntax and grammar and rhythm and all these things like that, that you take into consideration when you populate your books, with these people. And yeah, that's one of them right there, just listening to my own books, and it's, it can be wonderful and it can also be torturous, okay, because you'll think back, the rewrite period never ends, okay, there's no such thing as a book ever being finished. It's just there's that point in time, to coin the phrase from the NRA, when they drag the manuscript from your bleeding and clutching fingers and don't let you have it anymore, and then they do something horrible and put it in print and send it out into the world, and then there it is, never to be changed again like that. But otherwise, like it would be bad, because Tom, you and I would be sitting here talking about the 477th version of the Cold Dish.
You're right.
So there is that. It's kind of good when they do take it away from you at some point.
That's an interesting alternate universe to think about. Maybe we can do that that sometime. We'll just
maybe
just
I'm looking
give an hour on the versions of the cold dish.
Anniversary edition
yeah.
of the cold dish.
Right,
maybe.
Right.
What
right. We have Craig Johnson on again. We're talking once again about the cold dish. Yeah. you have a mule in this book. I was very pleased to see this. I'm no big farmer, rancher, anything or outdoorsman, but I did many years ago. I went out and interviewed an outfitter who takes people up in the Uinta Mountains, and he swore by. In fact, I got up on a mule, took a picture with it, and he swore by mules. He said mules are smarter than horses; they're more sure-footed, and you better be glad that they're stubborn. So tell me about this mule called Borax. You have to be a certain age to know why you called him Borax.
The way it was explained to me by a mule skinner, you know, going on the we went down in the Grand Canyon on the mule ride. Like, and that mule skinner's, you know, famous statement was, you know what, there are no such thing as suicidal mules. So if you're on the edge of that cliff going down the Grand Canyon, you find yourself arguing with your mule, you are wrong. Okay. I had the same experience because my grandfather was a blacksmith, like that, and he swore by mules. He said they were the greatest animals on the face of the earth. Like that, he said, yeah, they can be a little stubborn, but you have to explain to them. It's kind of like having a smart partner. You know, if you want to do something, then you better explain to them what it is that you're going to do and how you're going to do it. But they're sure-footed, like that, they're solid as they can be. They're not flighty, which is a problem, like at sometimes with horses, like that. And they all are also incredibly strong. Like that, I mean, whenever I was doing the research like that, because I mean, I knew about the Borax, 20 mule team, from the television show Death Valley Days, like getting, of course, the laundry additive. I remember seeing those boxes with the 20 mules, on that black and white box. And I thought, but I didn't know really a lot of the history of like what the real story was behind Death Valley and Borax and all of that. Like that, and when I discovered that, when they found those fields of Borax, that mineral that was extraordinarily effective in a number of different things, but mostly as a laundry detergent additive, they had to go into Death Valley, into the high deserts of, on the borders of Nevada and California. And the only time you can get in there, of course, is the summertime, like when it's about 130 degrees. And then they were pulling 30-ton wagons out of that stuff. There's only one animal that can do that, and that's a mule. And so I've, long been a character, I've long been a great believer, of the character of mules. The funny part, of course, was when my granddaughter asked me why it was that I was, calling the mule Borax, I looked at her and said, well, little princess, since you've never done a load of laundry in your life, so she had to have a little bit of an eye opener, and I explained the whole process to her about Borax. So.
Just a couple of minutes left here, maybe to fit this in. I'm fascinated by your popularity in France. You're probably popular in other places too. You just have a really good translator in France, or what's going on there? What are French readers picking up?
I'm a firm believer, that, the more languages I get translated into, the more I'm sure of the belief, that if you get a good translation, you get a good book. If you get a bad translation, you get a bad book. My French translator is a very good close friend of mine. The first language I was translated into was French, and she's absolutely fabulous. My French publisher, Gaumeister Editions, they're just an amazing publisher, and they really understand the books, how to make sure that what's in the American versions of the books is actually getting translated to the French readers, there are a number of things, that they respond to, French readers do. It's interesting because there are countries, in Europe where Westerns are popular simply because of the period Westerns. They want to read about the Old West. But what's different about the French readers is they want to know about the contemporary American West. They want to hear more about how it all turned out and what it's like now. And I think that they can recognize that there's an attempt, to try as be as honest as I can possibly be about the culture, the society, and the place where it is that I call home. I think they respond to that. And then the other thing I think they respond to a great deal is the humor that's in the books. Mm-hmm. To me, humor is essential. It really, really is. I don't think it's enough, to move those characters like chess pieces on a board through the plot of your book. I mean, to make them truly, dimensionalized, as fully developed, human beings, one of the main aspects is that you give them a sense of humor. Inevitably, whenever I'm teaching workshops or doing classes, I'll have students say, well, how do you get people to really invest in your characters? How do you get them, to really, get on board? Like, and I'm like, well, give them a sense of humor. Who do you like hanging around with? You like hanging around with the people that make you laugh, right? Inevitably, the next thing out of their mouth is, yeah, but what if I'm not funny? And I'm like, yeah, you got a problem on your hands at this point. I don't know what you're going to do, like, but you better get funny. I mean, you can conquer it in other ways, like by making your characters compelling in a lot of different ways. But for me, the easiest one is always a sense of humor, like that, because I cannot write a straight, line without thinking of at least three or four smart-ass responses to it, like that. And so that's why, Vic is probably one of the easiest characters for me to write, I have to be honest with you. So.
Just a minute left. Give us a teaser. What's the next book about?
Absolutely. Now, Tom, this is why I love you as an interviewer, like that, because I would get off the air here like that, and then Judy would say, you didn't tell him about the next book. The next book is actually a collection of short stories, the second anthology of Walt Longmire short stories. The first one we did about 15 years ago, and it was called Wait for Signs, like that, and the one that's coming out in November 2nd is called Have Courage, like that, and it's another collection of Walt Longmire short stories, like it, including an extended short story that probably could have been a novel unto itself, which is called a twist, a twist, something with a twist, like at an angel shot, an angel shot with a twist, which is bar code, for being in a bar and a woman feels unsafe with the person that they're with, and the bartender needs to get some help. And an angel shot with a twist means, introducing a character like Walt Longmire into the mix, like that. And yeah, that one's coming out like at November, and I'll be on tour for like about 3 weeks on that one. And then, of course, the regular Walt Longmire novel will be out once again towards the end of May. And that one's called A Soft White Dam. And the title is actually from the E.E. Cummings poem that the snowflake does not give a soft white dam upon who it lands. Well, poor Walt finds himself in a pretty drastic situation, but I think people will enjoy it.
All right, we'll look forward to those coming up. Got to get our fix of Craig Johnson, and we did today. Thank you. Always a pleasure, Craig Johnson. The latest
All
book
mine,
is The
Tom.
Brothers
All
McKay.
mine. What a blast. What a great
Thank
way to
you.
start my day. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much, and thanks everyone for listening to Access Utah.
It's one sky, many cultures. Skywatcher Leo T here as we dive into the end of August. Already wild weather in the Pacific and the world in general. Nice to see some strong rainstorms along with some thunder and lightning to accompany the breeze blowing the trees around. And yet still hot when the sun's out shining. Sun, as you know, being the star that keeps us alive in that delicate balance of life here on our deep blue orb with the swirly clouds and extending our senses farther out in the solar system with deep space probes that are out of our planetary system to probes checking out the rings and moons of Saturn and Jupiter, searching for oxygen in the ice oceans of Europa and the ingredients of life as we know it, looking at solid evidence of water on Mars and tantalizing signs of possible life in the past in the Martian planet. And then bringing the little Skywatcher spaceship back down to Earth and into the oxygen and carbon dioxide of the seas of life here, as we plunge into the beautiful, overwhelmingly powerful oceans where we experience another world, life forms that challenge the imagination, from sightless entities that live by the warmth of deep sea vents thousands of feet below the surface, where tectonic plates converge or pull apart, to seahorses, manatee, jellyfish, manta ray, and an almost infinite variety of life forms that defy the imagination with amazing intelligence, from dolphins who communicate in frequencies that can probably be picked up in orbit, whales that communicate for thousands of miles with their lovely, lonely song, to octopuses changing color dependent on their situation. Tingle T and I were lucky enough to have a submarine dive last week off the west coast of the island of Hawaii, going down to the coral reef with a couple of schools of yellow tang and other characters, sensing the intelligence when they all change direction simultaneously, the vibrant colors and the magic of being here, and the back of your head, the reality that most things we do transportation-wise are very risky. And as I am often talking about space exploration on this show and the risks taken to expand knowledge in human experience, it's the same in the ocean in many ways, that in the ocean, if you deep sea dive under all the pressure of the depths, you must decompress from the dive. From Wikipedia, the decompression of a diver is the reduction in ambient pressure experienced during ascent from depth or depressurization of a diving chamber. It is also the process of elimination of dissolved, metabolically inert gases from the diver's body tissues, which accumulate during the dive. And of course, when we come back up and it's a whole nother world, sky is full of many magical orbs above our rooftops, like Albireo, the gold and blue double star in the summer triangle overhead, mixed with the jibble-jabble, loops and trails of stars of the Milky Way. Follow the trails where you like. And more visual treats created when monsoons lit up the Utah skies with a rare type of rainbow. This is a tip from Laura Jones at KRCL and an article from Carter Williams at KSL posted Sunday. Monsoonal storms provided Utah with much-needed moisture and spectacular lightning displays over the weekend, and also helped provide some residents with a rare type of rainbow. It's called a moonbow. It only happens at specifically certain times when conditions are just right. It's not as bright as a regular sun rainbow, but it's very magical. Also, as of the writing of the script and the airing on UPR on Thursday, the big lunar eclipse will be happening on the 27th, Thursday, with almost the entire moon slipping into Earth's shadow. The show starts about 7:59 Mountain Time when the moon comes up in the east and will already be a bit covered. And it enters its largest coverage of the moon by 10:15 or so Mountain Time. And by 1 in the morning, it'll all be back the other way. As this program airs on KRCL on Fridays and Sunday, KZMU on Saturday in Moab, it will already have taken place, and hopefully you got to grab a view. Here's to clear skies. Keep looking up, look around, and get just a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.